Okay, so you come round to my house. Let's say I don't speak English, and I welcome you to my house, to my home in Turkey. And we're standing around in the kitchen, and you've just got in, and we're looking around, and I point in the direction of the sink, of the taps, of the faucet, and I make this motion with my hands, like I'm tipping a glass into my mouth, and I say, Alvaro Bey, Alvaro Bey, su içmek ister misin? Susadın mı? Su, su, su. Su içmek ister misin? What did I just say?
Do you want anything to drink or?
Right.
Hi, Joel.
Hello?
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the channel. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you. Thank you for
And
having me.
we'll talk about your project later on, of course, a really interesting one. But first of all, and as usual, I want to ask you about your experience with languages.
Okay.
When did you start? When did you realize the traditional grammar approach wasn't going to cut it, and th
Okay.
things like that? Because I think it's going to transition naturally into your project once you
All
get it.
right. Sure. Okay. Well, when I was about 9 years old, as a family in London, we started learning Turkish as a kind of family project.
Nice.
Yeah, it was great fun for me. I found that Turkish grammar made sense to me because it's a very regular kind of grammar. So I saw that others around me were struggling with it because, of course, the word order is like backwards compared with English, but it's consistent. So I liked it. But then what I would find is that when I would have conversations with people, I would realize that I needed a word. And then I would look up this word in the dictionary. And I would really try to remember this word, but I could never remember it when I wanted to remember it. And I would find that I would have the same need maybe several times, or maybe I would hear the word in different contexts, and then it would click. And it's like I knew that if it was me, I would need to look up the same word maybe 4 or 5 times before I had it in the moment I needed it. So that was maybe the first clue that
Makes sense.
something was missing in my approach. Then later on, I did Arabic, some Arabic for a year. And of course, with Arabic, there is this kind of complicated situation with the written version and the dialects. By the end of that first year, I kind of worked out what was going on, but then I didn't do anything with Arabic for a long time. What I did do, because this was after we moved to Turkey, I got one Lebanese film. I watched this Lebanese film maybe 5, 6 times, and I started to realize that it was kind of fermenting in my mind. It's like it combined with that year I had, and it kind of had an impact in some way.
And yes, sorry to interrupt. That year
Yes.
was tr traditional classes as well.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because we had some traditional classes, but also I had exposure to Lebanese dialect. But of course, there's this disconnect. It's like if there is something written, then of course it's in the book Arabic, like Fusha, it's written Arabic. But then a conversation is in Lebanese or in one of the dialects. And
Egyptian.
getting my head around, wrapping my head around that contrast took me a year. And then it was over and I had to go. But that's how it is. I'll tell you in when we were in Turkey, for a while we were living in the south of the country, and this was just after the war in Syria started. And there was a family, a Syrian family, who somebody told them that it was a good idea to move to the area we were in. In fact, it wasn't a good idea for them because they can't get residency or anything like that. But it was my neighbor. Nobody in the area spoke Arabic at all. And there was a nice family, but he was always calling me and saying, Joel, you've got to help me. Nobody speaks Arabic. And that kind of helped me to activate what I already knew in a way, which was good. And then we came to Istanbul again, and I used my Arabic more. But again, people keep telling me I'm good at languages, And maybe it's true in the sense that I'm okay with grammar, but I never really felt like I was good at languages because, you know, I tried every memorization technique I could find. None of them really worked. But somehow, after some interactions, things would start to click. But before the interactions, I could never make myself, you know, master something. That was what I always found. And also, when we were in the south of Turkey, I did try an experimental language teaching method, but it didn't work, you see. It was fun. It was interesting. You know, we had a bit of sign language. We had physical objects. We even tried a bit of singing. It was all great fun. But I realized they weren't really picking anything up from it. So all of that kind of told me that something was wrong in the skill building approach. And then I guess it was mostly during the pandemic, I found the input hypothesis. I started to read some of the things that Krashen wrote. And it made sense to me. It made a lot of sense to me. Yeah.
Cool. So that, and yeah, I wanted to ask you about Turkish specifically. Like, why did you start learning Turkish? You said it was a family thing, but
yes.
Was there any connection with Turkey? Or
no, well, we were living in that part of London. So there's especially like Tottenham, Haringey, you know, Green Lanes, that area.
Okay.
Anybody who's from there will know what I'm talking about.
Like North London, right? Or...
North London, that's right. Yeah. So that was how it started. And then, of course, when we moved to Istanbul, I was about 17, 18. And then I found my wife and we got married. And I don't know. I mean, depending on your definition, I might be bilingual because I started at that young age. But the thing is, even if you say, well, yes, it was still in the critical period or whatever, I know that when I started with Turkish, I was consciously learning grammar.
Right.
So I don't think it's really honest for me to claim to be bilingual in that way. Nevertheless, I'm functionally bilingual because my home language is Turkish. I speak Turkish with my wife every day. And even though sometimes we try to speak English, we try to force ourselves to do it because I know it's good for her if I can speak some English with her. Her English is very good anyway. But it's forced. It's like it's funny how that works. It's like we fell in love in Turkish, so we always speak Turkish.
Yeah, you got used to it. Yeah, it's true. So when you moved to Istanbul, you'd been studying Turkish for a while, but all grammar-based.
Mostly grammar, but of course, I was interacting with people a lot of the time. So in the beginning, yes, there was a bit of grammar, but after a point I started to find that detailed grammar analysis just didn't really help. It just getting out there and using the language and getting used to the language was always better than trying to start with a grammatical structure and saying, okay, well, here's this new grammatical structure. Now let's go out and try to use it. That kind of thing, it never appealed to me and it never worked for me if I tried it. So I just looked up words that I didn't know and went from there. That's what I did.
So, yeah, so you had that traditional instruction, but the thing that really helped you out was that interaction in the street.
Yes.
Because you were interested in talking with Turkish people. You were interested in the message, communication, which is the most important thing. Talking about, right?
Yes, exactly. Before I found the input hypothesis, I had thought that maybe if I want to study language at home, maybe I need to find some way to imagine a scenario where I will use the word.
Okay.
So I thought, I think I kind of knew that I needed some kind of communicative context. But then, of course, the idea that of input makes a lot of sense. And ultimately, I think one of the big hang-ups people have with the input hypothesis and hypotheses like it is that if you're really going to buy into it, you have to accept that your subconscious mind will do things for you that you are not consciously aware of.
Correct.
And I think this is a very difficult thought to make peace with if you have been raised on the Western mentality of, you know, the universe will be subjected to the power of our conscious mind, right? This is what we do. We will understand everything and we will control everything with our thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so to then to say, well, you know what, your conscious mind isn't actually good at this thing, and you need to take a step back and allow your subconscious to do its thing. You know, I think these days we're more receptive to that kind of thinking, even when it comes to things like, you know, psychology and treating more negative things. Like we're kind of gravitating towards that side. We're more making peace with the idea that the subconscious has something to give us.
Right. It's they both have their place, of course. But yeah, I know what you mean. Like adults, we sort of freak out when we don't have conscious control over something.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So when you're listening to a foreign language that you want to learn, you've learned to pay attention to form, to specific words.
Yes.
Which word did it use?
Yes.
What conjugation? What verb ending? Whatever it is.
Yes, because you think to yourself, if I don't notice this consciously, if I'm not aware of it consciously, how am I ever going to learn it?
Exactly.
It's anxiety, I think. It's like, I need to be clever enough to work out what's going on, and only then will it go in. It's a very natural thing to think.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
especially when you've been raised that way, when all the contact you've had with other languages occur in that way, right?
Yes,
all the language classes, language academies you went to, etc.
Yes. I think it's also worth mentioning that in the English speaking world, natural interactions in languages other than English are actually very difficult to come by.
Okay.
Because, right, for example, you do a bit of French. Like in England, when I was growing up, you might have like French in school, for example.
Yep.
Where are you going to use French? In France. Okay, go to France. You try to use your French. Guaranteed, the person you're speaking to has better English than you have French.
Right.
What's the point? Young people don't care about it so much. And even if they do, there is English has this magnetic pull. So, of course, you know, in the English speaking world, it is a problem that people don't understand the need for languages. But even if you do understand the need for languages, English dominates you too.
Right. Yeah. Everyone wants to talk to you in English as well.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. So, and once you came across the comprehensible input theories, Stephen Krashen, and so on, did you start learning a new language right away, or?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I'm trying to learn Russian through pure comprehensible input, but so far I'm only up to like 40 hours.
Okay.
Of using this. I'm already seeing the results. It's quite funny. And last week we had a Russian lady we were helping out. And I said, look, I don't know any Russian, but it's like she doesn't believe me. Because this is like little things I know how to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, during that interaction, I realized things coming out. It's quite an amazing experience. When you realize that you know something, but you didn't realize you knew it before.
Mm-hmm.
I just love that experience. I think everybody should have it.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just to clarify, when you said results, you mean that you were able to understand things, right?
No. Well, it's not so much that I was able to understand things, but I could like pick out some words, and I was able to use a few words, words that I recognized.
Right.
Of course, it's A1. It's basic. It's nothing.
Yeah, simple things. Still,
Yeah, but it's simple things. But again, it's effortless. It's like, you know how in your mother tongue or in a language you know, when you hear a word you know, you can't not understand it. It's just that. It's just like that. There's no what was that? It was in the word list. I can't remember what it means.
Right.
Yeah, it's just, like, you know it.
You're just there forever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so you could say spasiba or things like that. Simple.
Spasiba. Я не знаю русский.
Привет.
That kind of thing.
And then I'm guessing that once you read the theories and so on, you started reflecting on your Turkish journey. Like,
yes.
Oh, so this was actually the thing that helped me. Like,
yes.
I've talked about it many times. In my case with English, it was the MBA, watching the MBA in English that actually helped me.
What's in English?
The MBA.
The NBA, yes. Okay. Yes.
Because I was interested in the sport itself.
Yes.
But because of, you know, all the 15 plus years trying to learn English in school, high school, and so on, it didn't help me. But, you know, certain things become familiar. And even in the madness of those classes, you can pick up things here and there and listen to a mini story. So,
yeah,
it can help you a little bit. But it was good enough for me to understand what was going on.
Yes.
And I watched it for a long time. And, you know, in hindsight, that's the thing that really took my English to the next level, like for real. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, both my own experience, also my experiences of what didn't work.
Yeah.
Trying to memorize the dictionary didn't work. Having these like language learning or teaching techniques where there's like output immediately didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Like these set piece conversations didn't work. I came up with a game during the pandemic.
Okay.
where it's like we have like I called it Pommersion. You have a Pomodoro. Do you know Pomodoro?
The technique for like 25 minutes work or
right.
Yeah.
So it's not 25 minutes, shorter, but it's like periods where we must stay in the language, and then you have an intermission where we can speak English if we want, and then we go back to the language. Didn't work. Because what was happening, instead of having a conversation, everybody would prepare something, and then they would say what they prepared, and then there was no conversation. And then maybe I could have made more of it, but ultimately, again, it makes sense because it's like output-based. It's like... And then there's, I think, two YouTube channels that I watched did help a lot. One of them was Matt versus Japan, and the other was Days of French and Swedish. Do you know David, like Lamont? Because he goes through a similar kind of process, you know, on the channel. You know?
Right.
And, you know, it's you're building an internal model, and that model must be built with input, and you can't output from a model that's not there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very straightforward when you understand it.
Right.
But yeah, everything seemed to make sense. And I see a lot around me in this country who are trying to learn English, but they don't have much English. They're very halting. It's very forced. And then you realize, like, you have, like, gamers. Like, in Turkey, you have, you know, programmers and gamers. You know, there's quite a lot of interest in that kind of thing. You meet a Turkish gamer who speaks good English, and you're not surprised they have good English. Why is this? Why is it that they have good English and all of these people who are very highly educated to university level, that they struggle with it? What's the explanation? It's input. It just makes sense of so many things at the same time. So it appeals to me. And also, you know, okay, maybe what you could call me, what Krashen would say, maybe a super monitor user, for example, somebody who likes grammar and can play with it. And it's like, yes, I am good at that. I do have a skill with that. But my success with language is not dependent on that. I can feel it. I always knew it. And I was always looking for a way to transfer what I have to other people. It's like, I watch people struggling with grammar, and it's like, I know deep down, you don't need to struggle with grammar. You know, you can do this. But I don't know. It's very frustrating to me to see people lose hope in themselves, in their ability to learn a language.
Absolutely.
Because they're barking up the wrong tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I've talked about it like 1,000 times. I'll continue to do so. Like, it's not about talent. Like, what you were just talking about, yeah, I get what you mean. That when people have learned through conscious grammar study, again, they had that sort of hesitant style, the broken speech with a lot of pauses, right? Like, you know, but you might be, like you said, like a super monitor user, so you might be able to do that faster than most people.
Yeah.
So you can kind of trick some people, you know, because you're going to speak in that way, but
yeah,
it's not going to feel as broken because of your ability to go a little faster than usual, but it's still not the way
no
we actually acquire languages.
No, because even when I am able to kind of get by like that with conscious knowledge, I know how much I'm struggling to make that work.
Absolutely.
And when it does click for me, deep down, I know that that wasn't thanks to the conscious knowledge.
Absolutely.
I know this deep down. And it's all also why it's like when I'm told I'm good with languages, I think to myself, yeah, but there's something here I can't explain.
Yeah, exactly. But that's also the easy way out for people. And I don't mean this. I don't mean this in a bad way.
Yeah, of course.
Like, you know, if you think someone's talented for languages and you're not, there's your explanation. End of the story, right?
This is also true. This can also be true. You're right. It depends on what you're trying to do. I mean, if somebody, I don't know, feels under lots of pressure to learn a language and they don't really want to learn a language anyway, and they find a convenient excuse, well, I've got nothing to say about that. Yeah, I mean, that's their choice. But what is heartbreaking is to see somebody who is banging their head against a brick wall for no good reason, when if they take two steps to the right, there's a door. It's like, no. this pain is unnecessary.
Because there's a lot of people like that they actually enjoy languages. They actually want to learn languages because they love them. But as I always say, motivation is only going to take you so far, because you can be super motivated, but if you go about it the traditional grammar way, sooner or later, you're going to end up giving up because it's not going to work.
Exactly.
It's boring as hell.
Exactly. Yeah.
So after that period, well, you're going to tell us about your project in a moment, but when did you decide to start with your project? And yeah, like I said, you can tell us all about it. And
all right. So there's something called ALG, Automatic Language Growth.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you've talked about it before. Is it okay if I summarize it briefly?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you, because I think they're very similar, but if you can tell us the difference between comprehensible input and ALG.
Right. Okay. All right. Okay. So.
Because they're based on the same ideas, right? They're similar. Like input and
Yeah. Okay. So if you read Krashen's works, like The Natural Approach, the book he did with Terrell, and also Principles in Practice, you see that he's trying to take what we know about second language acquisition and he's trying to fit it into the classroom environment.
Okay.
So it's a lot like, you know, the expression is a square peg in a round hole. So the square peg is what we know about how language acquisition actually works, and the round hole is existing teaching practices and expectations.
Right.
And it's not just the curriculum. Society, the public, has it in their heads that there's a certain way you learn language. So when the kids get home from school, the parents are going to ask them, oh, what did you do in Spanish today? So you have to work with that. So what you end up with is a square peg with rounded edges. And, you know, you end up with things like TPRS, which is a great way of squaring that circle. You know, it's great because it gives people what actually works and gives them what they think they need at the same time.
Correct.
So, you know, if I did a little bit of English teaching at a company here in Istanbul, that also was from a textbook, and I also wasn't satisfied with what I was able to do. If I could do everything again, I would use TPRS. Because that's the easiest thing to sell. And when I say sell, I mean it's the easiest thing to convince people.
Yeah.
Because it kind of ticks the boxes of their expectations and gives them what they need. But so there was somebody called J. Marvin Brown in Thailand. He's an American in Thailand.
From the inside out, from the outside in, or the inside out?
Yes, that's right. That's what he wrote. So what he did was he bashed his head against a brick wall with the audiolingual method, hit rock bottom, and then discovered Krashen. And he looked at Krashen and said, look, if this is the square peg, what would a square hole look like? And he came up with something he called ALG, automatic language growth. Basically, you walk in, you sit down, you don't speak any Thai, and you just watch the teachers talk in Thai, but they make what they're doing more or less comprehensible thanks to, you know, what they're doing, their gestures, the objects in the room, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
No speaking, nothing, just watch. And it works. But, you know, I discovered this and I thought this makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. And also, there's a blog by Pablo Roman of Dreaming Spanish, because he actually went out there and did it. And he has a some blog posts, like a 3-part blog post, where he talks about his experience. He talks about the positive and the negative. And you can see, no, this is a real thing. This is not a scam. You know, it's a real thing. It's a real course. And what, for me, I looked at this and I thought, this makes a lot of sense, but I'm not quite sure how to use this.
Okay.
And at the same time, I immediately recognized that, okay, if ALG is correct, if this is the square hole for the square peg, why isn't it more successful?
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't everybody know about this? And like I just said, there's established expectations. You know, J. Marvin Brown was a local celebrity. When he talks about how he introduced this method, it was by the sheer weight of his own celebrity that he got it accepted where he was. It's because he was a very respected expert of Thai. And if J. Marvin Brown says, this is how we learn Thai, well, this is how we learn Thai then.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very unusual set of circumstances. And you think about it, with ALG, they're telling you to say nothing and just sit down for hundreds of hours. Does it work? Yes, it works. But on day one, you've got nothing to show for it.
Correct.
The end of month one, you've got nothing to show for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't do that in a school. The kids come home, the parents say, what did you do today? Oh, well, the teachers clowned around, but, you know, I can't say anything. It's like, no, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So where does my thing come in? Well, see, I'm a translator. I'm not an academic. I'm not a teacher. I can't convince anybody of anything on the basis of my own personal authority because I don't have any.
Mm-hmm.
But what I can maybe do is find a way to show people, give people a personal experience of ALG in a very short time. So, well, of course, my name on the screen is Jan Telekoman.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that is because I also have an interest in Tokipona. So Tokipona is a minimalist conlang, constructed language, which in its minimal form has only 120 words.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's a very interesting toy for applied linguistics because you can play with it for translation, you can play with it for language learning, you can play with it for lots of different purposes.
Okay.
It's like you can even think of it as a kind of semantic meta-language. But that you can speak, you know, I love playing with it for this reason. But also I thought, well, for a natural language, you need maybe, you know, at least, let's say, 40, 50 hours to have a measurable impact, let's say, or an impact that you can actually say, ah, oh, yes, I learned this.
Mm-hmm.
But with Tokipona, because it's such a tiny language, if you just have, let's say 10 hours of comprehensible input in Tokipona, then maybe the process might run a lot faster. And it's less of an investment of time, because even if you think ALV sounds interesting, if you're not sure if you can trust it, then nobody's got 100 hours to sit down on something that might not work.
Right.
If I tell you 20 minutes a month, you know, just watch this video, 20 minutes every day for a month. What are you going to lose? Try it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it works, then it gives you an experience that, yes, comprehensible input does work. And then you can take that experience and you can use it. You know, if you do ALG or something else, it doesn't matter. You have this personal experience that, hey, my subconscious really is good at this. You know, if it gets comprehensible input, it works. It does the work for me. Right. And this personal experience is useful. That's what I thought.
Mm. So, yeah, basically to sum it all up, you know, when it comes to comprehensible input versus ALD, they're sort of based on the same ideas, but I mean, not comprehensible input, but TPRS, you know, the method that you use in the classroom, which is storytelling, which is good, but they, because of the curriculum and the expectations and so on, you know, there's some sort of output from students that is expected at some point, right? And forcing the issue a little bit more, whereas ALD is just listening to it, you know, not saying a single word, and also the idea that you don't need to understand every single word, right?
Right, right.
But that's so, sometimes what, I'll just finish my thought. Like,
oh, sorry.
No worries. That's something that maybe in TPRS classes or things like that, I mean, they do a great job because of the storytelling idea. It's based on Krashen's theories, which is amazing. But sometimes they try to pay too much attention to specific words, right? To get their students to understand what this specific word means. And the difference with ALG is that you don't really need to do that either, right? It's just, if you understand what I'm talking about, if you understand my story or whatever it is, my book, or it's the process working, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm an outsider. And, you know, I'm an enthusiast. I'm not an expert. So I know I need to stay humble about these things. You know, I've seen things, I've discovered things, I want to share them with the world. But at the same time, I don't want to tell teachers how to do their job, because they're up against it. I have a lot of respect for K-12 teachers, because they have enough to deal with anyway. But they are also trying to force this square peg in the round hole. Mm-hmm. Language teaching. You know, whatever they need to do, do it. I mean, I don't want to be misunderstood. But I think it's, if you read Krashen carefully, what exactly is comprehensible input? Comprehensible input is when you understand the message.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how the message is understood. So, for example, let's say you come around to my place. You said you don't speak any Turkish, I think.
No. I know the word for tears. So.
All right. Okay. Okay. So you come around to my house. Let's say I don't speak English, and I welcome you to my house, to my home in Turkey. And we're standing around in the kitchen, and you've just got in, and we're looking around, and I point in the direction of the sink, of the taps, of the faucet.
Mm-hmm.
And I make this motion with my hand, like I'm tipping a glass into my mouth. And I say, Alvaro Bey, suçmek ister misin? Susadın mı? Su. Su içmek ister misin? What did I just say?
You want anything to drink, or?
Right.
You want a drink or something like that? Yeah.
Right. So you don't understand what, like, I just called you Alvaro Bey. Like, Mr. Alvaro.
Okay. You didn't pay attention to it.
Right.
Just to...
But su içmek ister misin? It's like, water to drink, would you like? Susadın mı? Are you thirsty? Right? But you didn't need to know any of that.
No.
Because the context and the situation and where we were and what I was pointing to and the gestures I was making gave you all of the meaning. So that was like 5 seconds of comprehensible input, because you understood the message.
Yeah. You didn't,
and that's the concept of the input hypothesis. And that's what ALD is based on, which is you don't even need to be able to pick out the individual words, let alone know what they're for. It's comprehensible input and your brain uses that. But what happens with things like TPRS is, you start by explaining the words you're going to use.
Mm.
And this meets the expectation of the curriculum. It meets the expectation of the students. It means they can go home and say, I learned the word for water today. Mm. Maybe this conscious knowledge can help to understand the input when there's not so many clues. This is also possible.
Right.
What's happening is things are getting a little confused, because when you get comprehensible input and you think that you understand what each of the words are doing, that's called transparent input. So if you have like two circles, the big circle is comprehensible input and the little circle is transparent input inside the big circle.
Mm-hmm.
So for sure, transparent input is comprehensible input. But when everything you do every day is transparent input, you think that that's all comprehensible input is. And we're back to what we said before about struggling to believe that your subconscious mind will do something for you that you're not consciously aware of. So you can still have this idea that you must notice everything consciously. You must have an awareness of what each word is doing in the input. Otherwise, the comprehensible input won't work. You can have this idea and do TPRS.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I'm not saying don't do TPRS, do it, but understand what is doing what.
Mm-hmm. You know?
So this is kind of why I think it's nice to give people an experience of ALG in a short time. It's like, you don't need to understand all the individual words. You know, you just watch these videos. If you understand the story, if you can like retell the story in your language and you think that you will have maybe 70, 80%, then that's great. You comprehended it. You comprehended. You got the whole picture. And that's comprehensible input. Okay, after 10 hours, you will have some tokipona. And then you have that experience and you can use it. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, I have several things that I wanted to mention. Like, yeah, the thing you were talking about, I interview like Japanese teacher Benny Komation, for example, here on my
really? Oh, yes, yes.
And she does story listening, actually. Yeah. She calls it story listening.
Yeah.
Which I think is pretty, is closer to ALG than TPRS in the way that she just tells stories.
Mm-hmm.
She does a lot of drawings and context and so on. So she doesn't use the native language at all.
No.
Doesn't check for comprehension, things like that, right? So what I mean is you can also do TPRS-like things, like telling stories.
Yes.
But without paying conscious attention to the words. I remember when I first came across TPRS and, you know, and related methods, like you said, they tend to focus on specific words or structures they're going to use for the class. Again, like we've been talking about it, but we understand that they need to do that in schools, for example, right?
Yeah.
They have some targets, you know.
Yeah.
So they go like, you know, to eat in Spanish, comer.
Right.
So drink, beber, and three or four different things. Make sure the students have them down at the beginning of the class, and then use them during the class,
yes.
Which of course is still going to be way better than traditional classes.
Absolutely.
But instead of doing that, if you can tell a story in which students are going to understand what you're talking about, thanks to your gestures.
Yes.
Like with the drinking thing.
Right.
Images, if necessary, to real life context, because in the end, if you're, you know, you might not know the word for singer in Turkish, but if you talk about Michael Jackson, okay, that's a singer, you know, things like that.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Things get confused very easily. So imagine at the beginning of the lesson, if like you tell me that you just told me, is it comer or something like that?
I mean, comer,
now, if you tell me a story about eating, I will pick out comer, which means that you don't have so much of a burden to make this gesture for eating every time, because you just told me that comer means to eat. So you're making the input a bit more comprehensible when you do that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, maybe next week I will forget that comer means to eat in English,
mm-hmm.
but you just gave me comprehensible input there. And that's what's going to make the difference. But because everything is like this,
that's
what's doing what, right?
Right. So, I understand. So that first thing help you understand my input. But my input was the thing that helped you actually acquire that specific.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And everything gets a bit confused.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny you mentioned story listening. Actually, the method I'm using in my stories is a kind of adapted version of story listening.
Nice.
Of course, I don't know what Benika Mason would think of what I've done with her method.
Okay.
I haven't asked her. I don't know what she would think. I hope she would I hope she would approve, because I've used like pictures and stuff. In her method, she prefers to use drawings. Okay. In a classroom setting, I think is a good idea. It keeps things reasonable and cost effective. I think it's great. I felt like I needed to do something a little bit extra for YouTube. But hey, I hope she would approve of what I've done. But anyway.
I think so.
Story listen. I hope so. I have to also give a shout out to Catherine Schechtman.
Oh yeah, she's German. Yeah,
yeah, fantastic. And she was the one who convinced me that story listening works with absolute beginners, or that it can be made to work. Of course, you know, I've done my best with it. It's not perfect. I've had some feedback that the first story is a little bit hard going, a little bit. I'm not, partly that's because of expectations, but partly that's because, you know, I could have used a simpler story. That's true. Mm-hmm. But the ones who continue watching, I've had good feedback from them. But like what you said, it's, I just feel like, can I use another analogy? I have too many analogies, but it's like language acquisition in the brain. It's like there's an engine turning that mm-hmm. will acquire the language for you. The fuel is comprehensible input. And like we said, comprehensible input means that you get the overall message. You don't need to have the forms consciously. You just need the message. So the fuel is that comprehensible input. Conscious knowledge about the language can maybe be a turbocharger if you use it right.
Okay.
But the problem is when you is when you have the package where you have the fuel and the turbocharger and you get confused about which one is the necessary part.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've come with a method that always has a turbocharger, always has some component of conscious knowledge about the language, then how can you really be sure that the turbocharger is necessary or not? So what I'm saying is, come with me. We'll take away the turbocharger and look, the engine runs. If you just have a turbocharger and no fuel, well, that's what everybody with traditional methods are doing.
Yeah.
But, you know, even if I show you that the engine's running with only fuel and no turbocharger, and 5 minutes later you put the turbocharger right back and keep doing what you were doing before, I still think it's a useful experience. It's like, I just said, if I'm in this position in the future, maybe I will use TPS because I know that I can't pitch ALG in 5 minutes. I just can't. I know I can't. But when I use TPRS, I will be conscious of what is necessary and what is a bit extra, what is maybe like the turbocharger, or maybe even what is actually a placebo. And when I'm conscious of this and I see somebody struggling, I will know that I will know how to reassure them. I'll say, you know what? Just focus on what's happening. Don't worry about the words. It will come. I will give them some confidence and we can continue. Otherwise, I will be worried that, oh, they must remember this word list.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Having an awareness of what's going on would make me a better teacher. And for a solo language learner, and that's the main point, really, it's like somebody who's self-motivated to learn language and who is looking for the best method. It's an experience. It's an experience. Come take the experience. What have you got to lose, right?
Right, it's 10 hours of your time, Toki Pona. Yeah.
It's fun. It's cute.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, but I was thinking, like, that's, I was going to say that the good news for me is you can actually think, like, as an adult, we're used to paying attention to words and so on, but you can change that. And what I mean by that is, I've talked about it many times, but when I came across crashing theories and, you know, comprehensible input and so on, I started my project. I was totally convinced by it. But even then, you know, even after a couple of years with my project, I would watch a series in a language I felt totally comfortable with, like English, Portuguese, Italian. You know, I understood everything, but I was still paying attention to specific words. Like,
yeah,
what did that character say? Did he use this word or that word? You know what I mean?
Hmm.
Because it takes time to change that, because we've, you know,
of course,
that's what we've done our entire lives, right?
Yeah.
But little by little, I've changed that. And mm-hmm. now I can, you know, whatever the language I'm listening to, I'm totally relaxed. I'm trying to understand what's going on. I don't care whether they're using said or half said, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. And
not only is that helping me even more, but I'm enjoying it so much more. Like just the series, because I remember actually watching the series and, you know, like trying to pay too much conscious attention to it.
Yeah.
First thing. And so, you know, even if the default for most people is to pay attention to it, because again, that's normal. I perfectly understand, but you can change that. That's the message that I want to convey here, right? And then, yeah, it's funny. You mentioned Catherine. Her videos were the thing that actually helped me start with German.
Oh, really?
I started learning German with her stories, yeah. Because I actually met her like in person in France. Really? I went to a conference, yeah.
Yeah.
I started watching her stories.
Yeah, right. So is it the ones with the fourth graders?
Yeah. All the...
Oh, they're so cute.
yeah, exactly. And actually, yeah. Because when the pandemic started, she started recording the stories at home and sending them to her students.
Yes.
But then she uploaded them on YouTube. And they're great. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. As a translator, of course, I'm kind of from English to Turkish.
Mm-hmm.
If you think in terms of the effective filter, then this attitude that you're talking about, I've also found this myself. So maybe a Turk would correct my work and say, well, that's not natural.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have this feeling of anxiety, like, why isn't it? What rule? How could I have known this?
Mm.
And the point is, at that point, I hadn't had enough input to know that. That's all it was. And then after a few more years, I could turn around and look at, oh, yes, of course. Yes, they're quite right. I couldn't explain it, but I had the input. And also, I think the effective filter is very important. You have to have the right attitude towards the conscious knowledge you have of a language. It's like the I like to use the map territory concept. So if you're moving to a new place, you can try to study the map beforehand. Maybe you're very good with maps, maybe you're not. No matter what, the map is not the place.
Mm.
It does not take the place of where you're going. It will be wrong, it will be incomplete, and it will not tell you everything.
Right.
It cannot tell you everything. You get there, whether you are good with maps or not. The more time you spend in that place, the more you will get used to where everything is, and you'll find your way no problem. So you're spending time in the territory, right? But with this conscious knowledge you have of the language, it's a map. It is not the language. It's not the real thing. It's a map to the language. And the language is this strange subconscious thing that we can't quite describe.
Yep.
Again, making peace with that is maybe difficult, but once you do, it means that you have a healthy relationship with grammar. It's like grammar maybe will help you, maybe not. Sometimes there are going to be exceptions. Maybe it's going to be wrong, but you have to trust what native speakers say. Yep. If this is what native speakers are saying, it's correct. End of story, end of conversation. It's like, don't care what your grammar book says. It means that the map was very useful, but now you found the weakness of the map, right? There is a street here. The map says there's no street, but there is a street. Okay, there is a street.
Yeah. And there's a tree in the middle. And
oh, yeah, exactly.
If you're looking at the map, you just go straight into it.
Yeah. Right. It's like, but this is how people treat grammar. It's like, the grammar says that there is no tree, so I will drive into the tree.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
You hit your head and let's try again.
Yeah.
And the funny thing I was thinking about is, even in your own native language, like, you can perfectly communicate, you can say things the right way, but if someone tells you to explain a rule, You need 15, 20 minutes to come up with some made up explanation. Because I remember when I started, there was a girl from India that she was studying to become a Spanish teacher in India. So, yeah. You know, you can imagine what the university course was about, you know, subjunctive, all the.
Yeah, of course.
But she would ask me some questions. I would have to think about it for a while, then come up with some weird made up explanation by myself. And I'm a teacher. I'm not just like a regular citizen when it comes to the language.
It's right. Yes. You know your stuff.
Yeah. So it just doesn't make any sense to try to learn it consciously.
Right.
It's a mess.
Yeah. I mean, people ask me questions about Turkish. Like we have you know, foreigners like me who are trying to learn Turkish and they ask questions. I try to give them a rule of thumb that will help them out. I don't try to give them the explanation. And there comes a point where I say, look, here's a rule of thumb. It will be right 9 times out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
Get your feet wet. You'll get used to it. That's what I tell people. Because you know, if I give you a rule and you trust the rule, then you're going to get frustrated with the rule. You know, I felt like I'd been sold a lie the day I realized that bilingual dictionaries are like approximations. It's like, I remember this realization. It's like, I thought that learning another language is like an algorithm. It's like, I take this word in English and it will be this word in Turkish.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize that there are sometimes some exceptions. And I think, oh, okay, well, all it means is that you have one word in English and you have two possible words in Turkish. And then you have like an algorithm again to choose between the two. And it doesn't work.
Right.
And it's like, I remember it's like, the dictionary is a lie.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's not a lie, but it's like, you know, this is the language. It's like, this word is this word. No, 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 no. In out of 100 situations where you use this word in English, maybe in 95 of those situations in Turkish, you will use this word. Yeah. That's the best you will get out of a bilingual dictionary.
Yeah, but that's also such a tough process to try to learn something. Yes.
Yeah.
And
nobody tells you this. Yeah. Nobody tells you this.
Yeah. And actually, I was thinking back to your example with the drinking thing in Turkish. I was thinking that actually what you need is, you know, when you listen to stories or examples like the one you just mentioned several times, right? You don't need to know that's the Turkish equivalent of "Would you like something to drink?" You just when you go with that approach, with ALD that you were talking about, with storytelling, in which communication and the message is the most important thing. How to put it into words? You build a mental representation, you know. So whenever you hear the words that you just said. In my mind, I'm going to build a mental representation of
right.
Whether I want something to drink. Not the words in English or Spanish or whatever the language, but, okay, so when I hear that expression 5, 10, 15, 20 times, you know, as many as necessary.
Yeah.
The 21st time, I'm going to hear that and, oh, okay, so I want water, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like I always talk about it with the simple example of an apple. Like, for example, with Spanish, I don't want my students or myself to learn that the word manzana is the Spanish equivalent of apple.
Right.
I want my students to have a mental representation of an actual apple when they hear the word manzana. Know what I mean?
Right, yes,
and exactly. And that works for, you know, it's a little example with just a word that is easily relatable to an apple, right? But that works for the language as a whole. So you're not thinking, oh, manzana, that's the equivalent of apple, right?
No.
You have the apple, the mental representation in your head.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
So, do you know how somehow I remember being quite little and thinking of this, how words sound like the thing they are. Like light. Light. Dark.
Right.
You know, I can imagine that when you hear the word manzana, it sounds almost like that sound when you bite into an apple and you rip the apple away, this sound, right?
Yeah, okay.
Manzana, right? I wonder if it's like that for you. I remember turning this over in my head when I was quite little and thinking, isn't it funny how words do that? But you see, that feeling comes from experiencing the word in many different contexts.
Right.
And deep down, I think the subconscious code, I think that the machine code of the subconscious is emotion.
Mm.
So you have feelings associated with apples. It's like, I really like apples personally. It's like, oh, there's this something special about them. But because of all the experiences you've had with that thing, where that word was used about it, you have this kind of emotional association with it.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like the thing it is. But when it's just like manzana, oh, what's, oh, apple.
Right.
That you don't have that richness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never thought about it. Like they look like they sound, you know? But I'm sure now I'm going to start paying attention.
No, it's just, well, you know, in Turkish as well, ışık, karanlık. It's like when I say these words, they mean nothing to you. But ışık sounds like light to me and karanlık sounds like darkness to me. It's just, it sounds right. It sounds right. It feels right. And that's what we're building. We're building an intuition when we learn a language. It's like, and like what you were saying before about when somebody asks you about a rule in Spanish. It's like what you're doing really is you are trying to make a map.
Mm.
And then you are taking the map and you are comparing with the territory.
Yep.
I've been through this process many times.
Yeah,
it's like somebody says, well, why is it that way? And then what you do is you say, oh, well, it's because of this and this. And then what you do is you take that rule and say, aha, but if that's true, then what happens if I take this rule and I apply it over here? It's like, oh, no, that's wrong. And then you revise the rule.
Mm-hmm.
So you make a map and it's like, oh, it doesn't work. Oh, now I will change the map. The territory is always there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Before, but suddenly somebody is asking you to draw a map. You draw the map and you say, well, can they use this map? Will it take them where they want to go? Ah, no. Okay, start again.
Yeah.
It's when you think about it like that, it's very clear that you know explanations about language are not the language.
Yeah, but it's also like you perfectly know the territory, but you don't know how to draw it the same way you know it.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you just make things up or, you know.
Well, it's like in Turkish, it's called kroki. I'm not exactly sure what it is in English, but you have these businesses and you're on the back of the business card, they have a diagram of how to get to their business. And basically it's like the nearest train station. It's like you go straight up, you turn right and you're there. It's like a map. It's horrible, but it gets you there, right? So
right.
Close enough. And a lot of grammar explanations are like that. It's like it gets you there, right? But it's not the real thing. It's if it works, great. But
absolutely,
it's a tool. Yeah.
So yeah, getting back to your project.
Okay, sorry.
No. That's perfectly fine. No, what I meant to say is, I'm gonna leave the link to your YouTube channel.
Okay.
Description and the first comment. But I think the name is the one you have here, like Jan Telekoman, right?
Yes, that's the name of the YouTube channel. The name, I called my YouTube series of videos, Opiline Tokipona. And I'm not going to tell you what it means because that would be a spoiler. But basically, if you search for OPETP as the one word, then you find it.
Okay.
I would also like to mention that what I'm also trying to do is... I'm trying to see if I can ask people to actually try it. Watch one video a day for 30 days. And then at the end, I want to have like a Zoom conversation and put it on YouTube and maybe make it a podcast as well. And I'm thinking that the first group of people will maybe are brave enough to try it. And then after I start doing the podcast, then people will listen to the podcast or watch the videos and say, hey, it works. And they will also do it. So if anybody wants to do that, then I'm calling it the 30-day comprehensible input challenge. So the address is bit.ly/30dcic. So 30-day comprehensible input challenge. So yeah.
Yeah, like I said, I'll leave all the links.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Thank you. Thank you.
Probably easier.
You're right. Yes.
And yeah, so basically the idea is like one video a day for 30 days, around 20 minutes each, right?
Yes, average 20 minutes. I have to warn you, the first few videos, you might not be able to follow the story completely. You're not going to understand any Tokipona in the first few videos. You might start to pick out little words here and there, but if you focus on trying to get the main point of the story, if you get to the end and you feel like you could like retell the story in your language more or less, mm-hmm. then that's fine, that's perfect. If you're willing to try it, then that's all it is. 20 minutes a day for a month, that's it.
Cool. Awesome. And I have that like final question for Tokipona. Like, how did you learn it?
Okay. I learned it from books. But also, it's very interesting. I discovered Tokipona a long time ago, actually. I think it was before the book came out. But the only time when I started to get good at it was when I did a 30-day challenge on Facebook. There was a Facebook group with a 30-day challenge. And the challenge was to record a video of ourselves speaking Tokipona for a minute.
Okay.
And I think that helped a lot. Because, of course, you know, this is a totally different subject, but there is such a thing as auto input. So,
Right.
So it's like I was calculating the sentences in my mind, but then I would use them, and I would also try to think that if somebody could understand them, if they listened and they didn't know any backstory, and I found that that really helped a lot. So that there isn't very much Tokipona content out there that's comprehensible for absolute beginners. That there's podcasts, but they're like advanced level. And if you want, you can go to Discord, and there are some Discord servers, and you can join the voice chats. I never really did that. If I did, I'm sure that would have helped. But yeah, you know, what my experience with Tokipona and the fact that it was that challenge that made it work really, it confirms what I've been thinking. But anyway.
But I'm guessing because it's a made-up language, the pronunciation is not a challenge.
No.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm thinking of the auto input thing that you were talking about. Because, you know, if you're learning French, for example, you know, when you're actually saying things, you're going to learn to pronounce them the wrong way, probably.
Sure.
What I mean, yeah.
Well, the thing with Tokipona is the phonology is almost, well, it's a lot like Turkish.
Mm.
So I pronounce it as if it's Turkish.
Okay.
It's correct. According to the rules of this, as you say, it's a constructed language. And it's like, well, here is the official list of pronunciations. So I just, in the beginning stages, I wanted to make sure it was right enough. And that was enough. So yeah. But like what you're saying, you know, auto input is a two-edged sword because you pick up your own mistakes.
Yeah. No, but it's a cool experiment. Yeah.
Thank you.
So I'll leave all the links, and if anyone's brave enough, no, just kidding, to give it a try. I watched the first video, so I might do it myself. I'll try to find the time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Because I love languages.
Yeah, of course.
And that can be an interesting experiment. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Tokipona is interesting for other reasons. It's a very expressive language.
Okay.
You might think that a minimalist language would be very like a taxonomy, like top down. You know, we shall divide the universe into categories. It's not like that. It's almost like if you asked a child to come up with 120 words of names of things that they experience, like what would they come up with? And Tokipona looks a lot like the answer to that.
Okay.
And so it has a very human appeal to me for that reason.
Hmm.
And it's an interesting exercise to take very advanced concepts and break them down. It's almost like explaining it to a child. Yeah. And, you know, that's always something worth doing. You know, working out how you would explain something to a child. It's quite eye-opening sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Someone forces you to do that. And I think it's cool.
Nice, nice. Interesting. Okay. So, well, any other thing that we didn't touch on that you wanted to mention, or
no, I think that's it.
Thank you for having me.
I do talk quite a bit, if you let me.
No, that's I'm sure it's been super helpful for people. It's been for me, and I love these talks as well. And
I'm glad. I'm very honored that you had me on, and yeah, thanks for having me, and I wish you continued success with your podcast and everything else you do to raise awareness of what works.
Exactly. Thank you so much. And yeah, and everyone learn Tokipona. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Joel.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for watching this interview. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it was helpful for you. And if you want to know more about language learning, language acquisition, like, you know, what's the best way to learn a language, ideas for language learning, the best resources at different levels. Here, you can find the whole playlist with all the interviews I've done so far with different researchers, teachers, polyglots, and so on. And finally, right here, you smash this guy right in the face to subscribe to my channel. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you in the next one. Bye-bye.